Welcome back, folks. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Let's see. We are here. We don't have a... let me see what's going on with my guest list. It's missing. Okay, is it? Oh, there it is. Just stuck to the other side of the page. All right. Good to have you all here. On our way to this conversation, I want to remind you all that the reason we're here partially is because of MeQ Baltimore's Credit Union. MeQ Baltimore's Credit Union offers a full range of financial services, helping its members and its community prosper for the last 80 years. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org. It's MeQ Baltimore Credit Union's banner. And as our usual tradition is these days, we have our national roundtable. Now it's time for our local roundtable. And what's happening in our communities here in the state of Maryland and Baltimore. You can join us here at 410-319-8888 with your thoughts and ideas as this conversation unfolds. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can send an email to talk@steinershow.org. Log on to the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page and have your thoughts heard there. I've been reading those comments as well all so long. So 410-319-8888. We're here in the studio with Carl Stokes, former city councilman for the 12th District and a founder of Banneker Blake School, community activist, educational activist in our community. Good to have you in the studio in a different form. Good to have you here, Carl.
I'm glad here, glad to be here, Mark.
Melissa Schober, who's called on the show many times and tweeted in a lot, is in our studio now, public school parent and education advocate. Good to have you in the studio, Melissa.
Thanks, Mark.
And Kim Chuhart, former candidate for president of city council and the Democratic primary, community activist, and a constant presence at Board of Estimates and city council hearings. Good to have you with us as well, Kim.
Thank you, Mark.
Hi, Kim. How are you?
Councilman, how are you? I miss you. You know that.
Oh, thank you so much. you're not calling me. Not that I'm complaining.
410-319-8888 is the number to hear to join us. Please do. 410-319-8888. Interesting. We had a couple of tweets that didn't make it in the last hour, but they actually fit into part of this discussion. Dominguez Urban tweeted in twice. Came at the very end of the show, so I didn't have a chance to see them. Only the very wealthy can see a future where the kids will do better. Even college degrees don't guarantee a living wage. And for good reason, their future looks bleak. More automation, self-driving trucks, and outsourcing despite Trump. That's the conversation we'll have one day, because I think that's really important to kind of wrestle with as well. But let's see where we are here. Now, we have the new mayor, 8 new people on the Baltimore City Council.
Right. Great.
I think it is great to have these 8 new members, see what they will do and where they will take us and how open they will be to kind of a new thinking about
sure.
our city.
Absolutely.
When Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake left office, she had not signed the Department of Justice consent decree.
She has not.
Which could have made it done. Now, there's a small window of opportunity. From everything I've been reading, and mm-hmm. I'm one of those maniacs who's read the entire report.
I read most of the report.
I read all of the report.
Okay, so
good for you too.
And know that what has to happen is the mayor has to sign the consent decree.
Sure.
I'm not sure if it has to go through the city council after that or not.
Or I think we have to acknowledge it in some way.
Right. So, but it has to be signed and then sent to a federal court, which has to agree to it. And then say it is now implemented. Then you have to find a monitor who runs that consent
sure,
decree.
Sure, absolutely.
And that has to. Then you have to put in a request for proposals. Who's going to do that job to oversee the consent decrees being carried out, whatever that is.
And an agree to a reporting schedule, publicly transparent reporting schedule for various milestones as part of the consent decree is typically what's happened in other cities as well.
And so exactly. And so one of the things is that if it's not done in the next several weeks and given to the court in time, a federal court in time, then January 20th comes, you have a new administration in the White House.
You do.
Whose attorney general will not push the consent decree.
No, he will not.
And it'll be over.
Right.
So this is a very critical conversation. I think the city doesn't understand what many citizens do not understand this moment where we are with this.
Right.
And that Mayor Pugh has a small window to get this done.
Right.
Will she do it?
Yeah.
What do we know? What do we not know? Carl, let you start, and we'll go around the room.
Yeah, I haven't had any conversation with anyone in the administration about this, but there is a small window, probably the end of the year, if not sooner, to sign this the consent decree, and obviously it is needed in the city of Baltimore. When you read the consent decree, you realize how ingrained this culture of badness is in the city of Baltimore. It's just horrible. And this consent decree is clear that this is not a foot soldier issue. This is a command issue. It is the command who enforces lock them up. It is the command who enforces the brutality. It is command who not only enforces but gives the orders to go out and act this way. At least that's what the consent decree said about the Baltimore City Police Department.
Kim?
You know, Mark, this is about reforming a police department that has, in documented proof, abused its citizens. And we're squabbling, so I understand, about how much that reform is going to cost. And at this point in time, we've lost residents to abuses and bad patterns and practices in this department. And we've not seen much reform from the inside. I appreciate our new police commissioner, however, the reform has to go beyond writing procedures, has to go beyond the normal structure of the department. You know, the citizens of Baltimore are demanding that we have some direct influence over the trial boards of officers who misbehave. We want two voting members seated on the trial board. You know, that's a bone of contention. That's an issue that the Law Enforcement Bill of Rights for the state of Maryland guarantees officers that civilians cannot participate in their discipline. That's outrageous. And as a citizen, we have been demanding that. And right now, that's the kind of reform, real gutsy reform, that we're asking for. And that's not happening. And that's one of the contentious items in this whole negotiations that's going on between the Justice Department and the city government.
And to piggyback on that, one of the things that I've heard Mayor Pugh repeatedly say is she's very concerned about the cost associated with reform. And while I appreciate that on one hand, I'm confused by it on another, and I've not heard her clarify it. We spend $500 million a year in Baltimore on policing. We have one of the highest per capita rates of police of any city in the nation. And yet, reforms that she herself said would cost someplace in the $10 to $15 million range apparently are out of reach. And I'm very confused by that as a constituent, as a citizen of the city, why in a $500 million budget we can't look and make reforms that would speak to culture, would speak to leadership, would speak to training that we do not have in place now. To me, it's an excuse to say, oh, well, we need to look at the budget and we're not sure about what costs will be in the long term when we have $500 million that we're spending on policing for policing that we know is ineffectual and unconstitutional, as the DOJ reported.
Now, so absolutely. Let's take some of this through here. And folks, I do want you to join us here, please, on this. We're going to hit other issues as well. But do join us now at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Send me an email to talk@steinershow.org. Log on to our Facebook pages, 410-319-8888. The consent decree is a huge, huge deal. And I want to talk about this with you all, get your thoughts and ideas on it, about what it would mean with, you know, citizens of the city from around the state who are listening to this program, people who may be in the police department would like to hear your thoughts. You can do it anonymously, 410-319-8888, not to jeopardize your job, and more, 410-319-8888. But one of the things, you know, that was made clear, I went to the OSI Solution Summit Saturday.
Okay.
And Sherilyn Ifill gave, who's now the head of the Legal Defense Fund,
sure,
gave a very stirring speech. And this was part of her speech was the importance of this consent decree, which is what made me start thinking about it, that there are a number of issues here. So let's look at this. So well, I'm going to get to the foot soldiers, but one of and the money part, which is clearly one of the things that that people are balking on The trial boards is something Mayor Pugh talked about when she spoke also at the Solution Summit. I'm going to talk about that in a moment. But let me start with this question of culture for a moment. I mean, it seems to me we're in a place now where we have an opportunity we have not had in the history of this city. The culture of the police, in terms of its relationship to the black community especially, has been building for the last 60, 70 years or more.
A long time,
mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You can take it back to the 40s even, when black folks were a minority in Baltimore.
That's right.
A large minority, but a minority. It was 30% of the people were black, but not like the majority city we have at this
Absolutely.
Moment, right? So, but the brutality against the black community has been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
The way we arrest folks has been around for a long
Absolutely.
Time. So the only way you change that, to change the culture, you know, you said something earlier about leadership, Carl, but it also is, as I think Sherilyn pointed out, it was if you don't get to the level of sergeants and patrolmen and begin to really change the nature of how we police from the street level out, you don't change things. And this is our chance to spend the long, hard, arduous work over the next 10, 20, 30 years for our children and grandchildren
Yes.
to change the culture of the police. That's why this is so critical, I think.
I got you. And I think that the DOJ's report says, I say it again, it is the command who is forcing the street guys to do the bad stuff. Now, whether... I think you're clear on saying that, frankly. And I think that people generally in the community have a good relationship with the guys on the street when they see the guys on the street and the girls on the street, when they see them. We all hate to talk about the good old days, but there was a good old day where you knew the cop knew you, knew everybody, and knew your and the cop would say, Carl, you know better. I'm going to tell Mr. Lawrence. Do you want me to tell Mr. Lawrence? No, Officer Smith, I don't want you to tell my mom. Okay. And so that went on. And so things have changed dramatically, of course, and the officers on the street don't know Mrs. Smith or Mrs. Dolores or anyone as well, or the small business guy, a gal. And so things have changed. But I still maintain that we're willing to work with the guy and gal on the street very much, meaning the community. But when orders come down, folk do what they're commanded to do.
Go ahead. Jump in, Melissa, please.
So
let me turn to Kim.
It's not that I don't think that the leadership is a problem, because I do think that the leadership is a problem, but the culture of the patrolman on the street, I think, is so far removed from, you know, the nostalgic picture that Councilman Stokes painted these
mm-hmm.
days.
Mm-hmm.
There are really very few foot police officers walking the beat in Baltimore, simply because many of them are stretched very thin. They're in their patrol cars driving back and forth all day. So that's a change to real community policing that we've seen in other cities that we have not yet seen, and I don't see any impetus for here in Baltimore. And certainly the culture, part of the culture of the Baltimore Police Department is in hiring. So who do we hire and why do we hire them? Who's coming into our police force? And should we expect more than what we have now in terms of hiring and where they live? Many of our police officers, the vast majority, do not live in the city. And indeed, some do not live in Maryland.
75% do not live in the city.
And, right. and when you're talking about a police force that doesn't live here and doesn't understand the community and only drives in to do their 9 to 5 or 8 to 3 or
right.
whatever shift it is, that is a different perspective. It's an outsider perspective and one that's not helpful. And that's reinforced by the leadership that don't live here. And that culture is harmful to residents. It others residents. It's unnecessarily brutal. It's unnecessarily suspicious because it lacks those relationships. And there hasn't been a return to community policing that I've seen that would reinforce those relationships between community leaders and leadership in the Baltimore Police Department. Certainly we see that with school police as well.
Yeah, and I agree, Melissa. If I could just jump in. New York City, Boston, L.A., you must live in the city. Boston has a six-month rule that you have to live in the city 6 months before you apply for the police department, even though you don't know whether you would be hired or not. So the culture is different. The police officers who would live in the city, who family would live in the city, would police differently and would act differently, knowing their children and spouse could be at risk if they're not doing a good job overall.
Kim, one of the things the mayor said also on Saturday was she said that she wanted to see a policy where that young officers were given deals on real estate apartments to move into, to rent, to become citizens here in Baltimore City, and then be able to buy homes in the city. I mean, she is saying that, which I think is really important, because I think that does have to shift. Kim?
Yeah. Mark, most of the residents that I know and talk to see the current state of the police force as an occupying force. What we know, and I initiated a bill in Annapolis for greater transparency around this concept of community policing, and for the first time we saw the real numbers of how many officers actually live in this city, and it's about 22% of the current workforce in the police department actually resides in Baltimore City. So we've got 80% of these guys that don't live here. They're not vested here. And they truly behave as an occupying force. The middle management is the real issue, as many of us see. And we've got to change that culture. And how do we do that? There's a whole litany of things that need to be done. We're relying on this consent decree, once it's negotiated, to enforce those changes in the patterns and the practices that have harmed us. We've got to either insist on this consent decree or do something here locally. I'm not advocating that we just do it locally, but we're going to need the city council if we can't get this consent decree passed. And we're going to need the folks in Annapolis, because the actual charter for the police department is a state charter, and the state determines what their guidelines are. So we're going to need help from Annapolis to really make this stuff work.
I mean, I think it seems to me in some way this is where the Hamiltonian meets the Jeffersonian. By that I mean, I don't think the city can do it alone. I think when you have a federal decree, it has to be done. Now, we can argue about how things were done in the cities and didn't get there, didn't complete all their work done, but the same arguments were made in Ferguson about we can't afford it, so let's not do it, and they were pushed to do it. In Camden, they literally disbanded the police. And to rebuild the police. But that didn't mean the police weren't on the job.
Right.
It means that they said, we're going to rebuild the police department from the bottom up.
Right.
And they did that in Camden.
She did.
Mm-hmm. And so I think there are ways of doing this, but it takes a push to make that happen. The biggest fear being that with this new federal administration, if it's not signed, it starts all over again, and what could happen next time when the next Freddie Gray happens could be even worse than we saw this last time.
Absolutely.
You're absolutely right, Mark. You know, we are going to need the state to change the Law Enforcement Bill of Rights so that we can have oversight, active citizenry oversight of the police department. And right now we're precluded by state law from doing that.
So let me go to the phones here, 410-319-8888. And Ricky, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you, sir, for accepting my call.
Thanks for calling.
For Mr. Stokes.
Hi, Ricky.
Oh, yes, sir. How you doing?
Good.
You're a very good man. I've known that for a long time. You do your very best to represent the citizenry of your constituency and of the city. Thank you.
Thank you.
All you, from Mr. Stokes to the two callers after him to Mr. Steiner, you're correct. All that you've said in terms of the community policing initiative or the possibility of it really has been 30 or 40 years in the making. Now it's to the point where everybody is coming together on a consensus platform that maybe this is something that we'll try. But I think Mr. Steiner was correct. It may just take a federal decree, and not just here locally, but universally in most urban areas. And here, particularly in Baltimore, I wouldn't say totally rebuild the police department, but its leadership, with the exception of Mr. Kevin Davis. For some reason, I think he wants to do the right thing, but obstacles like the Fraternal Order of Police, dissension, disarray, and people going against what he may want to do prevents him from doing that. He can't do anything without cooperation. I think he should stay, but I think something should be done to the leadership, remove a lot of these guys from their position, and gradually put other people their subordinates in their place by that action. They know that they have to do something different. But again, one particular young lady said that policing in the community by policemen walking on foot. I think Mr. Stokes commented to that effect too. That was an old time tradition which worked successfully. I remember out Cherry Hill, there was Officer Murdoch, who always kept up with us young boys and kept us out of trouble, me particularly. He showed a special interest in ways that really helped us a lot. And we could go to him with anything. He didn't cooperate with his co-workers on what we told him, confided in him. He helped us as a friend, knowing our predicament, our circumstances. He dealt with our parents. It was like he was different. You know, and that's the type of policing we need, sir. And thank you for all the time.
I appreciate it, Mr. Steiner. Thank you, Ricky, so much for calling in. We can get creative about what we can do about public safety in Baltimore, which I think is part of the debate, but we can't do any of it unless we get this decree signed.
Yeah, we definitely have to get it signed, and there are things to do. I wonder if either of you guys saw 60 Minutes yesterday talking about Columbia, South Carolina. It's totally changed. It's totally changed. Medellin, which had 6,000 murders
Columbia,
a year.
Columbia, South America. You said South,
South
America.
I meant, no, I didn't mean South Carolina. Lord have mercy.
Medellin is in Columbia.
I wish we could say Columbia, South Carolina. That's another story for another day. Yes, but it's totally changed. You got to go look at that and have a discussion about it another time. But it's a different world now. No more 6,000 murders. It's the cultural center of the country. And they've, you know what they did? One of the things they did is they built new development. They built a Harbor East or a Port Covington in the poorest parts of town.
Well, isn't that a novel idea?
In the poorest parts of town.
Melissa.
So I'd argue, in addition to the DOJ consent decree being signed, which I agree is incredibly important, our police department needs to pick a direction and invest in it with other city partners.
What do you mean by that?
And what by that I mean, I've been here almost 11 years as a city resident now, and in that time I've seen Project Exile, the gun registry, BFED, a youth gang initiative, the war room, another war room, a third war room. The Baltimore Police Department and the SAO claim to be data-driven, and they claim that they want to invest in these crime-fighting strategies. I'm from outside of Boston originally, and Ceasefire was a program.
Oh, yeah.
It's been evaluated by the National Institute of Justice, made a huge difference in the amount of homicides in Boston. Now, Boston is a different city. It's not analogous to Baltimore in many ways, but it is an evidentiary-based program that used a mixture of carrot and sticks to make good on crime fighting in the city. We tried Ceasefire here, but we did it in kind of a half-baked way. We had all the stick and no carrot. We've used Project Exile on and off, and it seems like we can't stick with an evidence base and with a direction for the police department. And I'm hoping that the DOJ consent decree would say, pick a direction and stick to it for more than 5 minutes, because I feel for the officers, too, when we talk about culture. They're being yanked to, today it's gangs, tomorrow it's drugs, then it's guns. Here's your top priority for this week. That's not a way to run a department. It's not a way to set priorities. What is our evidence base? What gets us the most bang for the buck? What does data-driven policing tell us? And I don't want it to be all data-driven, but we need to pick a direction and stick to it. And I'm really hoping that the new incoming mayor will look at what the Baltimore Police Department has been spending its money on over time and what's been efficacious. And if we don't have data to say what's been efficacious, we'll demand it from our police department.
No, I think that's absolutely critical, which is what you're describing. That's why this is so important. I think someone tweeted about that the defense saying that Trump administration won't follow up on the decree. So what that means is that when Trump takes office on January the 20th,
right,
his attorney general is Jeff Sessions.
Yes.
They've made it very clear their policies will not be about intervening in communities around these issues.
Sure.
And taking on the police. And I think that is, that's why I say that if this is not done before, signed before Trump gets in, there'll be no push on the part of the federal government
right.
to insist that the decree is signed. That's what I'm saying.
I understand. And I think Melissa just made an excellent couple of points there. And I think what difference would it make if we sign it now or not? Because they're not going to insist that it's done anyway. So locally and with the state, I understand. But if they're going to, if not disregard it totally, just do nothing about it to enforce it. And I think Melissa's points that Baltimore doesn't stick to any direction. We had David Kennedy from Boston come in and try to work with us almost 20 some years ago.
I remember that. Yeah.
To do that. And then we tried to restart it again when, you know, he came back to us a few years ago. But we won't stick to it. We won't say this is what we're going to do. And stay on that line. We go back and forth. We flip-flop. And so I am concerned that regardless of what decree is signed or when it's signed, if the local does not stick to it, then we're lost anyway.
So we're going to take a very short break, and I'm going to come right back to this conversation and then turn to Kim Shewhart. We want to talk more about this. We're also going to look at the conference taking place, Mary Pat Clark, and some of the new councilpeople have called around student passes and the MTA, which I think is really, people think it's minor. This is not minor.
Mm-mm.
We're going to look at this and also questions of development. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Do not go away. Welcome back, folks. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show. We're here with Carl Stokes, former city councilman for the 12th District, education and civic activist, of course, and businessman, founder of the Banneker Blake School, and which I should say, in full disclosure, I've been asked to join the board, and I will be joining the board of his school. That's not why he's on the show. So I just want to make that clear as well. Melissa Schober is a public school parent and education advocate in this community, and Kim Shewhart, community activist, and you all are 410-319-8888. Kim, did you want to jump in before I open the phones to Russ, our next caller?
Yeah. I agree that we need stringent policies and a strategic direction that has input from the citizens. And right now, every administration has thrown out what their ideas and concepts are for improving policing in the city, and it hasn't worked. And the thing that is missing has been citizen involvement in a meaningful way. And Mark, there's breaking news occurring right now in front of City Hall, and it's not on the policing topic. It's on the homeless issue. We lost a homeless man who died right in front of City Hall Saturday morning.
Who died in front of City Hall?
Mm-hmm. There's a press conference going on right now.
Who's holding the press conference?
Apparently some advocates are holding it, and Fox 45 has a news crew on site in front of City Hall.
And that is a real issue. I mean, we are going to be, as we do every year, on December 23rd, we will be bringing health care for the homeless on with some homeless people who have been homeless, and we'll be reading the names of all the homeless people who died in the city. My understanding from health care for the homeless that number is above 100 right now.
Wow.
People who have died.
Wow.
In this community who were homeless.
Unfortunate.
That's a huge number.
It is.
Right?
100, I mean, it is a huge number.
You add that to the number of people who have been killed and shot in the city, the 3,000 people a night who are homeless.
Wow.
And so this is something we have to address.
It's huge.
There were 299 homicides as of yesterday.
Right.
Yes, and we'll go over 300, unfortunately, I'm afraid.
Yes.
Before the end of this year, since we almost have a month to go. And so, you know, let me raise another issue here before I go to the phones. Russ, I'm going to come to your call, but I want to throw out there's another press conference taking place today that is being held by Councilman Mary Pat Clark and new council members Zeke Cohen, Chris Burnett, and Ryan Dorsey. On other people as well coming in, which is the MTA has said that student passes cannot be used past 6 p.m. They've gone to 8 o'clock, which allows students who have to go to work and have late school activities and are students in games for sports teams, that this is just an arbitrary kind of ruling, Melissa. This is that is just really detrimental to our children.
Yeah, and again, this goes back to my, can we not pick a direction in this city? if we're going to talk about youth crime, which Commissioner Davis has talked about, Mayor Pugh has talked about, we've heard about the uptick in youth crime and how youth are a concern and we need to provide more meaningful and constructive opportunities for youth in our city. But then on the other hand, we're going to cut back on the MTA pass to 6 p.m. And I don't know how many of your listeners, Mark, are regular riders of the MTA, but I am a daily Monday through Friday rider of the MTA, and the MTA service is abysmal. And to say that our young people are going to be cut off at 6 p.m. when buses are infrequent, late, no shows, and there is no real-time tracking information is ridiculous. These are young people who are involved in after-school opportunities, involved in sports, maybe picking up younger siblings to help out their working parent or parents at home. And now we're saying to them at 6 p.m., you don't get to ride the bus anymore. That's ridiculous and uncalled for. We should be welcoming our young people and not cutting off opportunities for them.
Yeah, Mark, I'm not sure who made the change and the time. Baltimore City Public Schools negotiates every year a contract with MTA, and they pay them around $2.30 per student for a bus pass. And in that agreement, they tell them what the hours are. So I'm not sure that MTA arbitrarily made this decision. I think the school system has a lot to say about how their money gets spent at MTA. And this doesn't make sense. And I haven't heard anybody from the school system come up and address this issue.
Terrific issue it is. We're at the charter school that I chair, we are giving our kids, because we have kids staying till 5:30 at least, for debate, robotics, for sports. And so we're giving them passes for those kids who are there past 6 o'clock. We give them a pass beyond the school pass that they have.
But you shouldn't have to do that.
No, we shouldn't have to do it. Of course not. These kids deserve to be able to get on the bus after they finish their evening activities at their school and be able to go home.
Because we're saying that we want to have schools that expand the day. So
right.
The kids are there from early in the morning to late in the afternoon to put our arms on these kids so they can succeed
Absolutely.
In life.
Yep.
But we're not going to give them past 8 o'clock. And if you're playing basketball, let's say if you have a basketball game tonight
right.
and you're playing for some school team, you're not going to go on that bus to play probably 7:30, 8 o'clock.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, North Avenue just passed the community schools language that I know Kim worked tremendously on. And so how can we have North Avenue be talking about community schools that wrap around children, that provide
right.
healthcare services, that have washers and dryers, that have all of these pieces to help our kids be safe and well at school, and then say, oh, but only until 6 p.m. After that, you're on your own.
Yeah, why wouldn't we allow them to ride the bus anytime? Anytime.
Anytime, because
yep.
there are kids who actually do their schoolwork and have a job and
right.
go home and get up
Absolutely.
The next morning.
Right?
Right. So if you're working in a restaurant, and you have to work till 10 o'clock at night, take a bus home,
right.
get up the next morning at 6 to go to school.
Yeah. How simple is this? This is ridiculous. You know, they should be able to ride the bus 24/7 if they have jobs, if they have after-school activities.
If we want them to be involved in cultural institutions in the
right.
city that are on offer for free.
Right. This is more than outrageous. This is stupidity.
Yeah, and where's the transparency? You know, the reason we know about this because a charter school was having difficulty, and they raised it as an issue in the press.
Right.
Nobody from North Avenue has said a thing about this, and that is the problem. Lack of transparency in all our government acts.
Well, I don't know if you can put it at the footstep of the school system didn't necessarily do this. I understand the MTA did this.
You know, if we have a contract with them, they ought to honor the contract.
Well,
the last version of the contract that I saw was one that went through 8 o'clock every evening.
Right. No. I'm saying that. Yeah. But
but
I've heard this was an MTA decision.
I've heard.
I
need
like
to follow
know.
It.
I don't know the.
Also,
I don't know the truth.
I don't know, but I know that we've received that edict for our kids, as every other school has received for their students.
But
it doesn't make sense.
And it came from North Avenue.
It came from North Avenue, but MTA.
So, and you know, this is it, and that, so if Larry Hogan's administration is serious about our children, then that's one of the ways he can be
yes,
serious about our
absolutely.
Children, about opening this up for our kids to be able to take the buses when they need it,
right.
whatever time of day it is. 410-319-8888, let's go back to the phones, and Russ, you're on the air, welcome.
Greetings, Mark, to you and your guests.
Welcome, Russ.
Hi, Carl, this is Russ.
Hi, Russ.
Mark, I called in the first hour, I didn't get through, and I called back in the first half hour, and I didn't get through.
Well, so, you're on now. Go ahead, man. See what you got to say.
What I'm getting at is, it's funny that in listening to the hour and a half, that it's the same thread that runs through all three conversations, and that's the ism, the one that starts with the capital R that we are getting away from. If Hogan was serious when he came into office, the first thing he would have done would not have been to cancel the red line. Number two, Carl is correct when it comes to command of police departments. That's where it all begins. When O'Malley was inaugurated mayor, she chose Carol Daniels to be his chief. He was talking about community-oriented policing, and Daniels, on the very day he was sworn in, he didn't believe in community-oriented policing, so he wasn't going to do it. But he didn't lose his job. So what I'm getting at here is, unless and until we get a grip on this race issue, it is impossible to make an academic or intellectual issues out of our problems. They're not going to be solved that way, I'm sorry to say. Now, I don't have all the answers. I don't know. But we need to really put the comments. It doesn't pay to hit the bullseye on the wrong target. That's what I'm trying to say. Hmm. Thank you.
So, anybody want to pick up on that?
He's right. It's amazing. I was just having a conversation tomorrow. Today. Shoot. What world am I in?
Alternative universe, Carl
right,
Stokes.
Westworld. But anyway, but I was having this conversation this morning. How many people in this country are really, really, really racist? Really racist. It's amazing when you hear the conversation that people now feel free to speak to. And it's no longer hidden. And I'm not saying it's an overwhelming majority by any stretch, but I'm just saying it's more than most of us realize it is. And it's not just race, it's sex, it's a religion, intolerance. It's amazing in this country. I thought we had really turned a sharp corner here. And I think we have turned a sharp corner. We did elect Barack Obama. But and this is not about Trump. It really is about the conversations that are revealed daily from people.
I'd argue it's a both and conversation, though. Fighting racism is not separate and apart from police reform any more than school reform is separate and apart from racism. It needs to be an informed conversation with citizens and community members here, as Kim said, that really involves the community to try to reduce and eliminate racism and policing practices that reinforce racism, while at the same time we're talking about policing practices that are community-based and that are sensitive. I think if we wait until we've, you know, conquered racism in some form, we're going to be waiting an awful long time. And I don't think that the 620,000 people who live in this city can wait that long for police reform. I certainly don't want to wait that long for police reform. It needs to be hand-in-hand conversation in which we talk about changing attitudes and we have police reform simultaneously.
There has to be some harsh penalties. People have to go to jail. I just feel that. I don't think you can train a bigot to not be a bigot. You can train the police all you want. If they come in as bigots, they're going to remain bigots. And that's not to say that the majority are. But you can't train that out of people, as I see it. This city, and it's not just racism in the city and in the culture of our police. I don't know how many times anecdotally that white citizens have said to me, I called the police and they said, well, you know where you live. Why do you live in this city? Why do you live here? I don't live here.
Happened to me.
It's happened to a number of, especially white people I know in this city, that kind of conversation has taken place.
Oh, yes.
You know?
After our house got broken into, that the officer said, you do know where you live, don't you?
Mm-mm. This is our police officers.
Kim? Trueheart?
No, we've got to embrace this idea that America is a melting pot. And as a melting pot, you know, you look around Baltimore. You know, I attended an event last night was a Muslim-led event that embraced all ethnicities, all other religious groups in the city. We had an attendance last night at this event, Catherine Pugh, our new mayor. We had Kevin Kamenetz from Baltimore County. We had Senator Ben Cardin, okay, our soon-to-be senior senator, all in the room with religious leaders, mainly Muslims, right? trying to come together about how to address the issues that are prevailing in our country and not let them overlap here into the city. I think we have great racial relationships amongst each other in this city, and there are some folks who have infiltrated our businesses, infiltrated our government, and want to make it bad for us. And we've got to keep promoting this thing of unity. It's critically important in this city. And we've got to teach our children to love each other.
I mean, we do have the potential to make this work in the city.
Yeah, absolutely, we do.
You know, and I think that tomorrow morning on our program at 10 o'clock, Ben Barber from NYU is going to be joining us, who's been talking about cities are the place that are going to be the engine for real economic, social, and political change in this country and the world. And he's been interviewing mayors all across the city and all across the country and all across the globe. And I think that's true. And I think, you know, and let me just say what I've been saying earlier about this decree. I'm not saying that Mayor Pugh won't sign it. I'm saying we have to ensure that it does get signed in time. In this city, and you know, we saw it being delayed. It was delayed under Stephanie Rawlings Blake. She could have signed it before she left office. Would have made it not a point we have to talk about anymore. We were just talking about how we'd be arguing over the implementation, how we want to change the police department, how we want to change public safety, who's going to be the monitor, and that kind of public discourse. But instead, now we all have to say, is it going to get signed in time for it to affect the nature of policing in Baltimore? So we're up against the wall.
We do not have to be up against the wall. And I believe that the mayor and the council are going to be good for this city. The new mayor, the new council, very good for this city. I think that they have to be different, frankly, than we've been administratively as in terms of city government for the last 3 decades, maybe 4 decades, they do have to say, we're going to change this. It's a hard thing to do. When the people who are most in need are the ones who have the less access, frankly, to their public officials. I'm about to cross over to dollars and cents and the ear of how you get the ear of too many of our elected officials, frankly, in this town. It's about dollars and cents. And I just mentioned Medellin in Colombia, where they decided to do the best, newest, greatest investment in the places where the humblest of their citizens lived. And you got to change. What's the number one issue in Baltimore? Poverty. 44% of all black children live in poverty, which means their families live in poverty. Over 85% of our school kids, reduced lunch, free lunch. And we won't address that. If we could have poverty in the city in the next 4 years, we'd have a greatly, dramatically different city. It all filters down after that.
Well, we could make some changes here in the city with regard to poverty. I think if budgets are priorities, and I think that they are, again, we spend $500 million on policing and relatively little on social justice issues like healthcare, like homelessness.
Right.
As a jurisdiction, we spend less than our surrounding neighbors on education. We only spend about 12% of our budget on education.
Amazing.
Most other jurisdictions, at least one in every four or one in every $5 are spent on education.
Right.
We could make changes here that would result in a more equitable and more socially just city, but I haven't seen the city council thus far make moves to do that. I am hopeful that the new city council will, but
yeah, they just got there.
I know.
And already beat up Trump. So
pardon my cynicism.
I think there's some really strong, bright young people who just got elected here.
I am hopeful when I hear, for example, the press conference about the MTA passes, because I don't know that would have happened under the last city council.
I'm not sure it would have. I think you've got. Go ahead. Let's go back, Kim. We can't forget you with us. Kim, go ahead. Then we'll open the phones.
You know, one of the things that we need to look at is the $44,900,000 that we spend on homeless services in this city. If we really only have 3,000 homeless people sleeping on our streets every night, that's well over $10,000 per homeless person that we get in this city. Now, the bulk of the money comes from the feds. The city only contributes about $8 million of that $44 million. But nonetheless, how we spend it is really imperative right now. And we're not tackling this problem in a meaningful way in any way. We're just doling out money to folks
right.
who really aren't interested in being homeless.
I agree. Right. That let me go to the phones here and get a quick thought of a call before we run out of time and then come back. I think you're absolutely right. How we spend that money. There's we could be investing that money in housing.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. So nobody
housing
has
first. To. Right. Housing first. That is how we can invest that money.
Right.
Again, one of the things that Mayor Pugh said when she spoke Saturday, which I liked, she said that we spend, I forget the number, she said, was it $350,000 or $3 million? I forget what it was, but dollars on paying the Bureau of Corrections to clean the streets of Baltimore. Mm. Why not invest that money in community organizations that can hire people in neighborhoods to keep the communities clean and put people to work?
Absolutely.
That's the kind of thinking that we need.
Right.
410-319-8888. Malik, you're on the air. Hi, Malik, you there? Malik, we lost Malik. All right, let's go to Kadri. You're on the air, line one.
Yes, good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to, I had one comment I forgot. It went out of my mind, but this last one you said about the homeless people in Baltimore, okay? I've been here 10 years in this city. First thing I noticed when I came here was the rows and rows, blocks and blocks of abandoned houses. The next thing I noticed was the rats, okay? Now, first thoughts on the rats was they were going to have bubonic plague out here, okay? The second thing, they had a mayor, I forgot which one it was, she curtailed the garbage pickup to once a week from twice a week in a city that had a rat problem. That I'll never understand, okay? But I thought later to myself, it was to prevent the city workers from having pensions. How you expect people to feel good about this, I don't know. About the homeless population, it's 1 million men. It's 1 million homes that's vacant. It's not rocket science, and I am not a college-degreed person, okay? I have some college, but it's just common sense. You have all these men, they need a job, they need self-esteem, they need to be the man that God made them. Tell me why can't these men be employed to clean up and repair these houses, contingent, and that they will have a place to live, that they can satisfy their needs for their family like they are supposed to and feel like men, notwithstanding the mental problems, because most of them stem also from being able to do nothing, okay, in the city. You tell me why there can't be a program instead of whatever they're throwing money at. She's right, they're throwing money at it. The next thing is about my people, so-called black people. Always we're the ones who's trying to cajole and get race relations fixed. Does it ever occur to you that white people in general do not want to be bothered with you? They really don't give a damn about you, and that it's time for us to do something for ourselves? It's not. I want to know why, okay?
Thank you, Kadri. Let's go to the next caller. Chris, you're on the air. Quick thought before we have to go. Chris, welcome.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Chris.
Paul Stokes just hit on something that's very important as an example, the way Medellin was turned around, and it was something that I looked at before, knowing that the poverty drives crime, and the crime in particular that was taking place in Medellin was drug crime, much like in Baltimore. So the way that it was attacked there is some of the monetary supplement, but also that transportation that was allowing people to get from the hills down into the main city to work. Again, there's an example there to be studied. Obviously, it can't cover it all in radio time, but thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. Let's get a quick call from Bernard, then we'll go around the room and wind out here. Bernard, welcome.
Hello? I just have two comments. Number one, I'm going to wait and see what the mayor elects. I mean, the new mayor.
She's mayor now, yeah, right.
Because I think she's aligned herself with the shakers and the movers of the city. And the other thing, I like this S. Call. When is he going to get back in politics? The city needs him.
Who?
Carl
Stokes.
They've forgotten me already, Mark. Thank you. I'm not getting back into politics. It was a great run. I'm working in education. I'm working with students. I'm always going to be a civic activist. And so I'll be here. I'm going to be supporting the mayor, supporting the city council, and working with them. And so I'm very happy to continue to work in that vein. But thank you for your comments.
So very quick closing thoughts here as we wind our day out. Melissa, sure.
Well, I'm hopeful, cautiously hopeful, that maybe if citizens move upon Mayor Pugh, we can move the DOJ negotiations further along the pipeline and try to get something signed before our president-elect takes office in January. In the absence of that, I certainly hope that citizens will be contacting the mayor as we come to the legislative session for Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights reform, for budget reform, and really to press upon her for our school spending and to improve education in our city.
Kim Trueheart.
Mark, you know, I am hopeful. I got to be hopeful about the new administration and the new council. And I will continue to be available and accessible to work with them, but I'm not going to wait for them. There are things that need to be done that we as citizens can do every day. And I intend to continue to be the active citizen that I have been. And I'm here if the new administration would like to have a conversation.
This is a great conversation. So every Monday you will hear this local panel is coming in here. Kim Shuhart has been a guest on the show many times. Carl Stokes, now no longer on the city council, will be joining us many times now.
Thank you.
On these panels. Good to have his voice in here. And right. Mr. Schober will as well. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
I like you better here than tweeting. It's good to have you in the house. You have a lot to say.
Thank
this
you.
Great. This is great.
So I also want to say, as we move on out of here, that Carl Stokes, founder of Banner Club Lake School, has asked me to join his board. I'm joining his board for full disclosure.
Yes.
Before that, I asked Carl to join the board of the Center for Emerging Media, which he's joining.
Yes.
For full disclosure, that's not why he's a guest on the show. He's a guest on the show because he's been on the guest on the show for the last 24 years and will remain a guest on the show.
Thank you.
Kim Shuhart and Melissa Schober, great to have you both in this air with us. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark, of course.
And speaking about legislative session, I really want to encourage all of you to join us for the annual Annapolis Summit, the 14th annual Annapolis Summit taking place Wednesday, January the 11th on the opening day of the Annapolis session at the Governor Calvert House. It's your chance to have your questions heard and hear answers and talk directly with Governor Larry Hogan, Senate President Mike Miller, and House Speaker Michael Bush. So get tickets by calling Haley Poling at 443-524-8161. That's 443-524-8161, or email hpoling, that's H-P-O-L-I-N-G, at thedailyrecord.com, and become part of the Annapolis Summit on the morning of January the 11th in Annapolis from 7:30 a.m. to 10 a.m. So please be there and be part of that session. We really want to have your voices there. It's always a great event. The Annapolis Summit is sponsored by the Daily Record, Stevenson University, Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, the Maryland State Education Association, Alexander and Cleaver, VPC, and WEAA. So please join us for that. We want to have you be part of that. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Henry. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our production assistant is Nadia Ramlagan. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. And to podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.